Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Phoenix, Arizona, it's time for Valley Business Radio, spotlighting the Valley's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Hello and welcome to Valley Business Radio, where we tell the stories that traditional media tends to ignore and help connect you with the right people. I'm your host, Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and I'm joined in the studio today by Monique Daniois, an executive coach and founder of MD Consulting. Welcome, Monique.
Hi, Adrian. It's great to be here.
Thank you for joining us today. And Cheryl Packham, owner of Codobi, a co-working space and business incubator, accelerator, hotspot in the city of Surprise. Welcome, Cheryl.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
You made quite the trek across the valley to get here this morning from Surprise to our studios in Arcadia. And I'm excited you're here in part because there's so much going on in your part of the valley that a lot of folks in Central Phoenix or East Valley don't tend to hear about. So I'm looking forward to learning more about Codobi and all the other things that you have cooking. Monique, let's start our conversation with you. Tell us about your work at MD Consulting. How are you serving folks?
Adrian, I work with executive leaders in corporations. And they typically will hire an executive coach because they have a number of pain points. Some examples are maybe they were just promoted to a new position and they're having some trouble adjusting. So they need help with the transition. Or they're leading a team that is not performing very well. So they need some coaching around that. I coach leaders many times on soft skills, emotional intelligence, business behavior, just trying to help them be a better leader and a better influence in their organization.
Yeah, I really think we need a better word than soft skills because they should be called core skills or vital skills or
critical.
The most important thing, critical skills. It's almost the label demeans it a bit. When it comes to leadership, when it comes to really getting alignment with people, these are the most important things. And leaders aren't often taught as they come up through the ranks in their career, these fundamental human practices. How do you get your clients to realize the importance of those? Or do they already know that before they engage you?
It's a good question, Adrian. Some of them come to me wanting to work on other types of pain points. And in the process of doing that, we discover that they need help with communication skills or having difficult conversations with people, things like that. Other times, they have gotten feedback on their 360. And that feedback has told them that they are causing abrasion with the way they communicate, the way they are handling their teams. So they come already knowing that they need to work on these things.
This goes right to the heart of something that I think is so fascinating about coaching and leadership development of a variety of modalities. Coaching is one of them, right? And that is that the most important results come from things that were often invisible at the time, blind spots, things that people don't realize that they're doing, that a trained coach can help them to uncover. It's almost as if they're the last ones to get it. With some of these things, right? Very successful, very accomplished people. They have strategies they've relied on to get results out of themselves and others. And they may not realize the degree to which that's not working for them, maybe in a new role or a new situation. How do you even begin to sell coaching services when the process is something that clients don't often understand and the results are sort of unknown yet because you haven't done the process. And the whole thing requires some realizations that they don't already have that are in their blind spots, so to speak.
Yes. I sell my services by letting people know that I can help them resolve their pain points. And some people say, well, I don't have any pain points. Everything's going fine. And so I say to them, well, what kinds of things are you worried about? What's keeping you up at night? What's giving you a headache? What is feedback that people have told you? And then they start thinking, okay. And then I say, well, what are some of your goals? Some things you've been wanting to accomplish, but you haven't been able to. So that gets them thinking. And I actually have them put a list together of these things. And then we delve into it one by one, and we start to root cause what some of these issues are.
Yeah. You must bring your own intuition and experience to bear on this as well. With over three decades of corporate and entrepreneurial experience, you've worked with a lot of people in a lot of different situations. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how that has shaped the work you're doing today?
Sure. I started in the corporate sector when I was 23, and I had big goals. I wanted to influence people. I wanted to train and help people grow and develop. And I soon found out that I was hitting a lot of roadblocks. So I switched jobs, changed companies, still trying to find that ideal company, that ideal situation. And I was very disillusioned with the corporate politics, with the dysfunction. There was no work-life balance for me or for others. And I just felt like I could do better coming in from the outside as a third party, you know, to give a different perspective on things rather than as a corporate employee. So I stayed in the corporate sector for 20, 25 years, but I gathered a lot of lessons learned, a lot of best practices. I switched positions, but met a lot of people, understood the true pain points of what people were going through. And then I left and started my own business as an executive coach.
You know, that's a leap that a lot of people want to make. And it's somewhat challenging to actually pull off because on the one hand, when you're in the company environment, you have deep knowledge of the problems, the behind the scenes stuff that outsiders aren't privy to, but you're very rarely empowered to do anything about it in the way that you would like to. And then when you are outside of the company, you essentially have to gain permission and access to the decision makers to not only get the engagement, but then to get the work done. Trust must be an essential part of that process. How do you begin to build that trust from the outside with the leaders who will then hire you to help them develop their own leadership?
I have a background that is has been from a variety of different companies and organizations. So that has helped me build my portfolio from being a corporate employee. And then my education adds to that. I've got two business degrees and a master's degree in organizational psychology. And I did not want to go on to achieve my PhD. So I ended up with a number of certifications in various other topics. So I first really let them know about my background and then my education. And over the years, I've accumulated a lot of client testimonials. That helps a lot because when a potential client sees the results that someone else has achieved, that helps build trust in itself.
You know, a lot of times in my own experience, providing training in communication and personal storytelling to leaders and teams within organizations, you often find one finds oneself in the situation where the leaders think their people need to do this work. And so they are excited to bring you in to make their people better and increase their performance and their effectiveness and, you know, cut down on problems, reduce turnover, whatever those pain points are. And there's always a moment of truth that happens in these conversations when they realize that they can't, well, that I'm unwilling to do something with their people that they're unwilling to do themselves. And that we really need to start looking at the human being who's leading the operation before we can get into the gears and the nuts and the bolts of the way people are relating. Because culture is about communication and it starts from the top. Are there situations that you can refer to at whatever level of anonymity is appropriate where you can give us an example of maybe someone who didn't initially see the value in this but came around and had and got some great results? Can you think of one of those from your...
Yes, many. A senior VP hired me to work with his sales team because they were having performance issues. And a lot of interpersonal issues and infighting and things like that on the team. So during the course of that assignment, I sent out some 360s for his team members so that they could gather feedback about themselves. But I also had that senior VP send one out on himself. And all the results came in, and he was shocked to see what his feedback was on his 360. So then it became a very critical conversation, because then it was no longer about the team and that they were underperforming, but it was about him and his skills and what do we need to do to get him to where he needs to be. Because it is, you know, it's based on influence. He's got to be a good leader to lead his team, and he's got to model that same behavior. So it can be quite an eye-opener.
One of the things that outsiders don't necessarily realize about the way coaching works is that the process is in some ways led and directed by the coach, but that it really is co-created between the coach and the client. Can you talk a little bit about some of the methodology and how you get this work done with people?
It is a very collaborative relationship, and that's how I frame the very first coaching session, is that this is very collaborative. I'm not here to tell you what to do. We're going to walk this path together. And I have a lot of tools that I use to help them reflect and do self-discovery. I ask a lot of open-ended questions, because it's really about getting them to open up and do more reflection. So with open-ended questions, they are able to have a lot of aha moments. And with that, with the tools, the assessments, I also provide them with action items between sessions, because it's not just about having a coaching conversation. It's about, okay, now you have to go out to work every day and apply these skills. So these are your action items to handle between sessions. And then we debrief on those in the next session so that we make sure they're on track and things like that.
You know, I'm struck by an aspect of your background that's in your bio, but you haven't mentioned, and that is your own athletic endeavors. You, a former competitive bodybuilder, weightlifting, hiking, yoga, Pilates, skydiving. I mean, there's a number of physical accomplishments that many of which I'm assuming have required a kind of coaching relationship. Is that accurate?
Yes.
In my own experience, 13 years and 35 pounds ago, as a competitive triathlete, the program that was developed by the coach was both best practices and it was personalized. How has your own athletic endeavors shaped the unique approach you take to coaching? Because some things all coaches are going to do the same way, and other things are going to be a unique expression of your own skills and insights and experience. What's that unique mix for you at MDE Consulting?
I weave a lot of work-life balance techniques into my coaching. And that's something that when clients come to me, they don't really talk about at first. This is one of the things that gets uncovered over time. But they tell me things like, I'm traveling 3 weeks every month. I rarely get to see my family. I'm exhausted. And my team isn't performing well. So we start looking at their own health and what they're doing and how they might be out of balance and how to get that back in balance. And we talk about things like exercise and nutrition and sleep and things like that. And once they can rein that in and start to practice better health habits, they find that they start to become a better leader. They are better for their people when they're not showing up exhausted and grouchy from not sleeping at night.
Yeah, better for their families as well, I imagine. You know, it's such a appropriate metaphor, I think, because muscles that are developed out of balance or soft tissue work that's not being done along with the training, all of which leads to injury, leads to breakdown, leads to problems. I mean, I registered for 3 Ironman triathlons and never made it to the starting line of any of them. The first one was financial. I had forgotten that because the event was happening in Germany, that would also mean airfare and hotels and in the summer. And so I just hadn't planned for all of that. But the next two had more to do with my own training and my own injuries in the process of training. And it really seems to me that as you're working in those soft tissue areas, so to speak, right, with a leader, looking at their life, looking at their, you know, their energy, looking at the way that they take care of themselves, that you're really helping them avoid the meltdowns and the breakdowns and the
Yes, it's very proactive. And discipline comes into this too. So to be a good leader, you have to be disciplined at practicing your skill, practicing your soft skills, your emotional intelligence skills, your conversational skills, and that takes discipline. And as an athlete, it was a lot of discipline that it took me to get into the gym every day, to eat right, get enough sleep. So I try to weave that concept into being a good leader. You know, it takes discipline. You have to stay focused on it. You have to be very aware of your behavior and your actions on a daily basis.
You mentioned in your opening remarks that you often start the conversation around pain points and that sometimes there's a denial that they exist. I think one thing that can be said for the world of work is that it's not always a hospitable environment and that people, in many cases, don't feel it's allowed to admit that they're struggling or that they're suffering. And the higher up the proverbial ladder one goes, the less they feel they can be honest about their struggles, their personal struggles, their leadership challenges. Is that something that you find you need to address directly with them, or do they slowly begin to open up over time? And how do you nurture that relationship from, you know, the natural defenses that they carry around every day, we all do, to the point where you can actually get the work done?
A lot of it starts with earning their trust. And so I share a lot of my experiences with them. But it amazes me how many leaders feel very alone in their role and in their pain points. They think they're the only ones. And so I share with them experiences of my own and experiences of other people that I've coached, keeping everything anonymous, but they initially are hesitant to open up. But as time goes on and as trust develops, they do open up. And they have problems that many people would think senior leaders do not have. For example, I had a conversation with a friend a few weeks ago, and I was telling them how I am coaching a senior leader around time management. And they said, well, a senior leader at that level should not be having trouble with time management. And I said, well, you would be surprised. And these are things that senior leaders don't want to admit, but they are having issues with something like time management and prioritizing. And maybe at their level, that shouldn't be an issue, but reality is that it is an issue.
Yeah. And what a gift to have a confidential, external sounding board relationship where not only can you guide them through some best practices, you can also be there to listen for the discoveries they need to make for themselves. And let's talk about listening as a methodology for a minute, because this is something I am convinced through my own experience is not well understood. Most people think that communication skills are a function of speaking, which is why all the investment tends to go towards public speaking training, sales training, all of the things that have to do with talking. But listening is the foundational skill in communication. And for a coach, listening is your superpower. What would you say about listening and its role in your relationship? And how do you develop that? How did you build that listening muscle, so to speak?
Well, I'm an introvert, so listening comes naturally to me more than talking. So that's a natural piece of it. But I had to develop active listening, which is different. It's more, you know, you don't just sit there and absorb information. There's ways that you actively listen. So I had to develop that skill over time. But again, that came relatively easy to me. And it helps in coaching, because by being a better listener, that helps my client to be a better speaker and talker. And they let their information out as I listen. So that's one of the pieces of feedback I often get from clients is that you're such a great listener. I normally would not say this to anybody. And I am the kind of person where people come up to me in the grocery store and just start talking to me and they just start telling me things and they're perfect strangers. So it happens naturally, but there also has to be a level of trust there with the client before they actually start to really open up. But it's a critical skill. You're right.
It's not very well taught. And I don't know about the coach training and things. Maybe there are exercises and methodologies that you get there. But for the most part, people are led to believe that active listening means nodding and saying affirmative things like, tell me more. And really, those are cheap party tricks. The activity of listening is a deep activity. And as you say, it almost pulls out of the speaker things that they didn't realize they wanted to say. So I don't know how to describe it. It's more in the realm of Jedi mind tricks than party tricks, right? But it certainly is the way in which conversations become magical. It's all about the listening.
Yes.
Is that something you're able to then train your clients in so they become better listeners? I'm convinced, by the way, if we simply made people better listeners, a lot would get better. My wife would say that would be true of me as well. So this is for everybody. Can you train listening skills as you're coaching a leader?
Yes. And as a matter of fact, many of my clients come to me and they say, I've been told I talk too much. And I don't know how to change that. That's just what I do. I just talk. And they're getting feedback that they're not good listeners and that their people think they don't care about them because they're not listening enough. And they want to learn. They want to learn how to do this. So I do have a lot of resources that I send them, and we role play in coaching sessions. We talk about listening. We talk about the components of listening, the different techniques you can use to listen. And really, it boils down to being very present in a conversation and trying to eliminate distractions. We are all so distracted with everything that's happening. So that's the first thing I have them work on is eliminate distractions when you're in a conversation. And then the rest will come from there. So it can be taught, yes.
I agree 100%. And this is something similar to what I do more as a trainer than as a coach. But it definitely, I think this is an area that almost everybody can continue to develop. You know, by way of wrapping up this part of our conversation, it just reminds me of something that a client of mine said to me a year or two ago, which is that practice is something we do when we're kids. We practice a lot of things. We practice walking. We practice talking. We practice reading. We practice piano, whatever all the things we do. As we move into adulthood, we lose a relationship with practice as a part of our life. Of course, when you look at high performers in any field of endeavor, what they do that got them there is practice, and particularly a very deliberate, difficult, and regular kind of practice. The same goes for our listening skills. We need to discover the practice of listening and incorporate that into our everyday life. You know, with so much in the news about toxic work environments and bad behavior, horrifying behavior from leaders, often male, in many different fields of endeavor, I think there's something in the work you're doing that, while you may be working with folks one at a time, is really attempting to bring balance, bring harmony, bring peace, bring compassion to an environment where that's not always been the high value, the high status kind of activity. Do you relate to what I just said? Is there some kind of mission or purpose that's driving you in this regard? And how would you express that in your own words?
Certainly. My mission is to build better leaders worldwide. That is the mission that I'm on. And if I have to do it one by one, that's okay with me. It's still very fulfilling for me. And my thought is that they have to go out and influence many other people in one day, teams, peers. So if I can work with one leader and help them be more influential, they can go out and spread that. So it's very fulfilling for me.
Very well said indeed. Monique Denyat, executive coach and founder of MD Consulting. We may have some more conversation here in a few minutes, but I want to turn to our other guest in this session, Cheryl Packham. You're the owner of Codobe, and you've got a fascinating background as well, but why don't we start with talking about Codobe? What is Codobe, and how are you serving folks out in the West Valley?
Thank you, Adrian. Codobe is a smart workspace. It's a get work done space. So what that means is we keep things very minimal. It's got the bare necessities you need to be able to come in, get work done. We're operating through technology in an automated platform to keep our prices low for our clients that come in. We're located in more of a residential area, so it's a little more convenient. You know, I believe that there are some barriers to non-traditional work, like, you know, where can you go to work that's not a coffee shop, or do you have to commute downtown to a co-working space? So this is kind of a place where, you know, you may have a home office, but you need to meet a client and you really don't want to go to a coffee shop. You can get online, book a room, and have access to it in as little as 15 minutes.
There's so much in what you just said that I think we really should unpack. And let's start with co-working itself. And I know Codobe's not a co-working space, but it is a place where people can work near each other and flexible hours and access and all of those things. Co-working as a phenomenon is something that is certainly on the rise. There are many people who seem to sneer a little bit at the fact that there's a new co-working space opening every minute, which first of all is not true, but second of all, I can't see the problem here. I mean, why is this kind of space so important for the kind of work people are doing today?
Well, Adrian, as I'm sure you know, the world is changing. People can work from their cell phones. I mean, 30, 40 years ago, that wasn't even really thought of. But as people are able to work more flexibly, they're able to travel more, they're able to have like more of a work-life integration, they need a space to be able to be more productive. And sometimes a home office is great for that, and other times it's not. And so a lot, and there's also people who want to meet more like-minded people, and that's where co-working spaces in general really build a community of people who are doing similar things and focus on this non-traditional, this different way of working remotely or flexibly or creating their own business or brand. And I think that it's just really incredible to see this trend where people are able to kind of just reach their goals and work towards what they want.
There's a lot of different types of people with different roles and different businesses that can benefit from a space like this. Let's break down a little bit that kind of mass of folks into some of the specific categories. What are the different types of people that you see who need something like this as a part of their life?
Okay, first and foremost, freelancers. We're all hearing about the gig economy. There's people who are working full-time on sites like Upwork, Mom Project, things like that. So freelancer used to just mean like a freelance writer, but now it can be a freelance anything. People are just taking on their skills and they're going out and performing them for people. Obviously, we have professionals, lawyers, accountants, things like that, who maybe don't need an actual physical office. They're meeting people, especially in this valley. We have such a large geographic sprawl. You need a place to meet in, you know, pretty much every corner of the valley if you're servicing different clients. So you've got the work from home, the startups. You've got your online educators, you know, the ones who are teaching online, also the ones who are taking school online. So there's just a really wide variety of people who would be looking for a space that's, you know, not a coffee shop or a library, that just need a place to get out of the house and get some work done.
Your original concept wasn't this. You started with something else in mind and got to this. Can you talk us through a little bit the evolution of the Codobe concept for you?
Sure. So a year ago when I originally launched Codobe, it was more like a family-friendly concept, which was really interesting, and I really was excited about it. But through, you know, as we learn as business owners, we have to pivot. Sometimes we create something that isn't a product that people want, and that's, you know, sometimes you need to pivot and take a different direction. So through some learning rapidly over this last year and pivoting around some personal challenges, this automated workspace was born. So,
and let's talk about the automation aspect. I know automation as a service or as a consulting service is something you provide to business owners. You have this ability to help them look at parts of their process and figure out how online tools and automated processes could help them. But Kudobi itself is powered by automation. How does that work and why does that matter?
Okay, so it works. Let me back up a little bit. So when I first started this business, I had no idea what an API was. I didn't know how software talked to each other. I was kind of a tech geek in high school, but I lost it through through my military career, kind of focused on other things. So I started learning as fast as I could on what's available and what's possible today. Through that, I realized software integrates very nicely with each other now. And I started just putting pieces together to see how it would work and was able to find off-the-shelf stuff that talked to other off-the-shelf stuff and was able to kind of create a system that I didn't even think was possible without, you know, $100,000 customized, you know, software solution. So it really led me down a path of just taking different pieces of software, connecting it together to create a system that just kind of puts everything where it needs to go.
So when somebody wants to book space at Kudobi, how do they interact with this, with the place itself? Obviously, at some point, they're going to show up and walk through the front door. But what you're describing is everything that happens before that. Okay. And this is also part of making it affordable is by automating a lot of that. What's the process like from a user's point of view?
Sure. So a user would visit our website and they could select between signing up as a member or just booking a room. Let's walk through the book a room process. So they need a room for today at 4 p.m. They'd get online. They would click book a room. They'd look at the calendar, see what's available. They would select the room, the amount of time that they needed. It would take them through the checkout process. They would check out. At that point, they would receive an email with the access information for the door that is able to be accessed via a smartphone app. So they would download that app, log into it, set up an account with that, log into it, and then they would show up at 15 minutes prior to their booking time, open the door, go and use the space. There's nobody there to greet them, so you know it's automated, but there is people available, so if they needed to speak directly to me, they could call or ring the doorbell to speak to our team members who are available. I say it's unstaffed, but it's not unmanned. Like we're there in spirit, but we're not, you know, greeting you at the front door. So they use the space and they leave and the door locks and they're good to go.
Unstaffed, but not unmanned. I like that actually, because my experience now, I met you over at Kudobi, I don't remember, last week, was it?
I think so.
Time flies around here. So, and it was bustling. And you know, there was people meeting in one room and there was stuff happening in the other place and the kitchen and the you know, but you know, my experience was I was walking into an environment that was friendly but not intrusive, and I didn't realize this until I went there. I'm not an introvert. I'm not a simple introvert anyway. I'm an extrovert and a hermit. I don't know if you put those two things together, but I don't mind being in public spaces and engaging with people. I really like it. I come alive. It energizes me. But then I'm happy to just go home and not see people for a long time as well. What I noticed was I liked the fact that just coming there was no, I didn't have to interact with somebody at the front. I didn't realize this was going to be something that was important to me until I experienced it. But the fact that I could just open the door and walk in and then I found you and we sat down in a room and had a meeting and I didn't know that the non-human part was going to be refreshing. That sounds so right. Strange because I love people and I'm an anthropologist who's dedicated my entire academic career and my professional practice to engaging with people. But something about the psychological barrier of like, oh, I'm going to have to see this person. And I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just that literally the gatekeeper phenomenon wasn't happening. Like there was nobody I had to tell like why I'm here and be scrutinized in that way. I don't know. It just had a nice feeling to it. What are your thoughts about this rambling thoughts of mine?
That makes sense. And I would often describe myself very similar. I'm an extroverted introvert, if that's even possible. When I'm around people, I love to be around people, but I like to be around people on my terms. Not everybody likes to walk into a room where they don't know anybody or to have to explain, like, why are you here? If you're at Kudobi, it's because you're supposed to be there. And that's, you know, you don't have to go in and check in and try to get through the gatekeeper. And I think that is intimidating for most people, especially if you've ever worked in sales. The gatekeeper at the front can be awfully intimidating, you know, so.
The other thing I really like about your concept, and I'd love you to unpack this a little bit more, is that you're not really locking people in to a membership, although memberships are available and there will be preferential pricing for members booking rooms. But literally anybody who finds themselves in the neighborhood or needs to have a meeting in an hour could schedule a room, communicate with the person they need to meet. This is where we're going to be. Walk in, make themselves right at home. The flexibility of what you're designing there in terms of, you know, it's availability to people who need it is also unique. So why are you doing it that way?
I think flexibility is really important because you don't always know you're going to need a space until you need a space. You know, you don't know what you don't know. So I think the flexibility aspect of it is really important for the people who need space like that. A lot of them are starting up businesses or they're trying to get something off the ground that they really don't want the monthly overhead of a commitment of a membership. So it's just really important to me to be flexible and affordable because I feel like that's what really drives those people who are trying to get started with something, with whatever their passion is.
Yeah. You know, as somebody who finds myself in different places all around the Valley on a regular basis, you know, just knowing that there's a place in Surprise that if I wanted to have a meeting with somebody in the West Valley, I could say, let me see if I can get a room. Yep, we're good. I'll see you there at 2:00 and have it just happen seamlessly is very attractive. Now, let's talk about your vision for this because right now you've got this location. The process of getting the location was interesting and accelerated. You were explaining this to me last week. It happened very, very quickly from concept to execution. Let's start with that. Can you tell us that story when you decided to make this happen, how that all played out?
Sure. So it was about May, I think, when I decided I'm going to start my business. There was a lot of research I was doing to just determine, you know, what would make sense for the area. One of the biggest challenges I faced was finding real estate leasing agents to actually take me seriously. I had really not a big business background. I had a bachelor's degree, but I had never operated my own business. So to get a place, to get anybody even to show me places was impossible. So I actually started looking on my own and found this space advertised on Craigslist and thought, you know, might as well just try and give it a shot. And it was amazing. The people were amazing. They treated me very good. They were willing to sit down and listen to my business idea. And they really believed that it was something that was worthwhile and was willing to lease the space to me. So it was an interesting learning experience. Like I said, I've learned a lot. Part of the reason I started all this was I could do this or go get a master's. I chose to do this instead. It was a really neat experience and to find people that are like, yes, we believe in entrepreneurs, we believe in startups, and let's give this person a shot. And here we are a year later, you know, and it's been really an incredible journey. So,
well, as I say, it was certainly bustling when I was in there, and yet not intrusively so. You know, there was people in rooms, you could see them, but it wasn't loud. It was comfortable. You know, we were able to have our meeting undisturbed. What's your vision for this? Where's this all going? Is this going to be a single location and you just want to build your and deepen your connection right there in Surprise? Or do you have another idea in mind?
So my big vision is I'd like to see these in small communities throughout the country, maybe even the world, to be able to reduce the barriers for entrepreneurship, online education, as well as remote working, which is not always an option in some smaller communities. One of the biggest barriers right now in rural areas is internet speeds. So while, you know, if we can find a way to provide more access to that, it might open up new opportunities for people who wouldn't have had them otherwise. So that's my big vision. I want them to be as common as the McDonald's and the Starbucks, you know, for a place for people to work that they don't, you know, that they have more options.
You know, there's so many different services that touch our lives and that are important to us that are becoming available through apps. And, you know, we can get a ride, you know, from Lyft or the other company. We can get a ride from Uber or Lyft. We can, you know, get a pizza. We can get all the things. There's no reason why we shouldn't be able to book space and find a place to work. The internet speed thing is really important, I think, because as so much more of our business becomes digital, those speeds are really important. You grew up in a rural area, is that right? Is that part of what shapes your commitment to making sure that internet speeds are there?
That's right. I grew up in Green River, Wyoming, a small town. It's known for its Trona mines. You probably don't know that, but that's what's there, the Trona mines, and then also the oil field in the area. And so growing through high school, while we did have business classes and things available, really the only viable options was go to the Trona mines, go to the oil field, or join the military. I chose option three. So, I wanted there to be more entrepreneurship opportunities. I always wanted to start a business. Through high school, I'd tell people that, and they just kind of, you know, laugh. That's just not what people do. The businesses are established in our town. You can't compete with them. And you aren't going to be able to do any of the, you know, the tech-based businesses because we just don't have the infrastructure here. So that was the reality.
Yeah. You know, the military plays such a formative role in the lives of people who serve in many ways for good and also in some other ways. But it's not an organization that is in and of itself terribly entrepreneurial outside of perhaps the special operations community, where kind of thinking for yourself and doing things on your own without permission is part of the nature of that kind of job. It's a hierarchical organization. It's in a way reminiscent of some of the worst of our big corporates, where, you know, tradition and bureaucracy create layers and layers and layers of things, some of which supports getting the work done and some of which is a barrier to getting the work done. How did your military experience shape you in particular? Because everybody takes away something different. Again, some positive and some not so positive. How did that play into the work you're now doing and the way you relate to others in the community?
So there was a lot of things I learned in the military. One was that there are ways to coach and lead people into becoming very successful and motivated. That was definitely one of the strong suits I learned in adapting to environments that, you know, you have to make instantaneous decisions and be coached through that, as well as a lot of process. I mean, as far as having outlined procedural manuals, the military is top-notch for being able to identify a process for anything, you know, whether it's taking apart a rifle or doing performance evaluations for their personnel. Like, it is proceduralized. It is... And that was one thing that
there's the PowerPoint deck for everything. It used to be field manuals. When I was a kid growing up and hanging around the Army surplus store, you know, it was always the field manuals, but now it's PowerPoint. Everything is PowerPoint.
PowerPoint, yes. And while that does serve its purpose and has a place, it's also something that, you know, I'm glad to finally be away from death by PowerPoint.
Or just plain death. I mean, combat duty does not always leave one in the best place.
That's true. And so really what shaped this business most of all was when I actually was medically retired early due to some injuries that I had on my deployment. And I thought I was going to be in the military forever. I thought I was going to work full-time in the military, and I didn't really have a backup plan. So when I got out, there really wasn't a whole lot of job opportunities. I was still in Wyoming. And, you know, I was looking around, but it just wasn't, the opportunities weren't there that I needed. And then I had my daughter. So I refocused my life and kind of focused on raising her and getting my bachelor's degree. But what really focused me into this flexible work was that I realized that because of some of the challenges I had, a traditional 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job just wasn't really practical for what I needed to be able to be productive. And so I wanted to create a place that other people could be productive, just if they were going through the similar struggles as I was.
Monique, this is something that I'm fascinated by in big organizations as well, because there's an increasing awareness that physical health and corporate wellness programs, you know, are a response to the fact that people have not always been healthy at work, mental and emotional health, and places to practice one's faith, places to breastfeed. Like, there's so many things that are human things that for so long were not supported. It's not like they were denied, but they just, there was no space. This is kind of, Cheryl, what got me thinking about this. A physical space to nurse, to pray, to work out, to just lie in child pose, whatever, right? Are you seeing a shift through the lens of your work with leaders? Are you seeing the organizations themselves changing in regard to supporting the physical, emotional, mental, spiritual needs of the humans that work in these companies?
I am, yes, because it's critical. Physical workspace, physical environment is critical to productivity. It especially if you're talking about introverts, we need space, we need quiet. Sometimes the lighting, you know, bothers an introvert. And if you're in an environment where you're expected to be creative, there needs to be a certain type of space for that. So I think organizations now are finally getting it. They're listening to their employees and to the needs of their people, and they're creating different spaces than what they were in the past.
We've had so many different people pass through this studio that have spoken about something related to this actual topic. We've had a restaurant interior designer who would actually refuse the interior designer logo and say it was more of an experience design, because we're talking about not just visuals, but also acoustics, flow, you know, all kinds of other things. We've had builders who are doing specialized construction for schools and nonprofits and corporate headquarters who are responding to a growing trend in the general building industry toward wellness, building for wellness. And this touches on everything from the quality of the light to the air and the kind of systems that are working in the background to equalize and circulate and do all kinds of stuff. Like, we are way beyond HVAC at this point. It's all smart. It's all high tech. It's turning on and off outlets in individual rooms to manage the flow of power. And it's kinds of mind-blowing stuff. And yet at the same time, Cheryl, when you go to open a location, you're committed to being a high-tech space, and you have to adapt to an already built environment, at least so far. Maybe in the future, you'll be building purpose-built locations. How do you address some of these? Again, it's kind of like the soft skills conversation we were having. How do you address some of these more invisible aspects of the environment, making sure people feel comfortable, making sure they feel safe, making sure that they feel at home so that they can get work done? That's the primary goal. But you're not putting in the bean bags and the beer kegs and the foosball, and you're not in any way, and almost intentionally, kind of avoiding that, you know, Greek life sort of, you know, feel. Why is that, and how do you address these issues?
Well, that's a great question. I address these issues through just making sure that people, like you said, feel safe through the security that we offer, feel comfortable. We have, you know, the multi-adjustable office chair that, you know, people might not always appreciate a comfortable chair until you don't have one. And desks that are able to be moved and relocated throughout the room to, so someone can find their creative space, their environment that makes them feel the most comfortable. Lots of natural light is really important to me. I don't function well under fluorescent lights. It's just not my thing. So I like to be able to have the blinds open, the lights off. You know, those are important factors. So a lot of thought goes into creating a space that people are going to be able to make their own, make it feel comfortable without all the fluff, the extra, you know. It's not going to be designed chic. It's going to be functional and minimalist.
And look, don't get me wrong. There's nothing wrong with kegs and the cold brew on tap and all of those things. But your vision of a functional workspace doesn't rely on those kind of extra accessories. You're really building the basics, the foundation. And well, Kudobi is not a co-working space in the traditional sense. It's not a community-driven space in the traditional. You don't have community managers and things of that nature.
That's right.
There is, by nature of human beings coming together in a place, a community that is emerging. What's your sense of the broader trends that are happening in the area around your location there in Surprise, in Peoria, and in other places in the West Valley? There's a lot of vibrant business that's happening, and it doesn't always make headlines in quite the same way. What are you hearing with your ear to the ground about this nascent business community?
There's a lot going on. There's a lot of passionate people who are really excited about new and innovative businesses that are coming in the area. One in particular that I'm pretty excited about that's actually going to be a part of our permanent part of our space at Kudobi is Promeneo Tech, which is a low-risk coding boot camp, a post-secondary coding education. And they are really building a foundation of just a different way to educate people on and again, reducing barriers to education, which is really exciting. There's also several other community events that are happening. You know, West Valley has a 1 million cups. There's other things that are going on. It's just really an exciting, vibrant community. Peoria, Surprise, and all, you know, all the way down to what's the one, Buckeye. They're all like really excited about bringing in new business, building vibrant communities. It's a really exciting place to be a part of in a small business.
Absolutely. And I think if folks aren't paying attention to those developments from Buckeye, Goodyear, Litchfield Park, Avondale, up to Surprise, Peoria, Glendale, et cetera, they're missing out on at least, well, according to the articles I read, 40% of the future growth in the next 25 years is happening in that area. Certainly, we see the headlines with Nike's plant in Goodyear, with data centers, things of that nature. But you know, through our lens here at Business Radio X, we're really looking at everything from the solopreneur, the small business owner, all the way through to the SVP, the C-suite executive. We want to include all of that as we serve the Fortune 500,000, not just the Fortune 500. You're bringing the AZ Founders Guild to your location soon. Tell us a little bit about that. We had Vincent Serpico and Jennifer Klum in here a few months ago before the very first meeting of the AZ Founders Guild. You're going to be hosting the Western version of this. What is that and how is it going to go down?
The AZ Founders Guild is a peer-to-peer mentorship. So it's exclusively for founders. And what we mean by founders is people who have built a business from scratch. They're starting up or they're about to start up a business.
So not just technology businesses, but a business that you created rather than a franchise or something that you are doing on behalf of somebody else.
Right.
What happens at the AZ Founders Guild and what can people expect if they were to come on, what is it, the 7th?
The 7th, yes.
Yeah.
So the AZ Founders Guild is built on the premise that we all have something to teach and we all have something to learn. So we're looking for anybody who wants to come in and mentor on a specific subject and anybody who wants to come in and learn on a specific subject. But we ask that you are prepared to give, you know, mentor in something. We know everybody has something to teach and everybody has something to learn. And you get the opportunity to get just-in-time mentorship that is really what you need at that moment in time. You get to be around other people who are going through similar stuff and really get that encouragement when you need it the most.
I love this concept. I haven't attended one, but I know from talking to Vincent that he's very committed to that peer-to-peer idea. No vendors, no pitches. It's just really meeting people and giving advice and getting advice. Two very important dynamics of the peer-to-peer mentoring. Cheryl Packham, owner of Kudobi. This is a fascinating conversation. I'm excited by what you're doing out there. Thank you so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thanks for having me.
Monique, I know that service is a big part of your practice, even beyond your coaching practice. You're on your way to Europe. This is something you do regularly. Tell us a little bit about that and why that's an important part of your life.
I love volunteering. So I'm super interested, Cheryl, in the AZ Founders Guild. I volunteer every year in Europe. I'm involved in English immersion programs. So foreign business executives join these programs overseas to learn English, get better at their business English, learn about business culture in the U.S. So I'm one of the volunteers, and I'm headed over there in a couple of weeks. I'll be there on business, but also to volunteer for the month of September. And I just love giving back. I love teaching and coaching, so I'm involved in this program. I cover my own ticket, and then once I get there, room and board is covered, and I meet a lot of great people, a lot of great executives, and I learn from that too.
You know, just as people shouldn't sleep on the West Valley, I think they shouldn't sleep on the rest of the world. I mean, there is so many exciting things happening in different markets. You know, Africa is exploding. 11 of the fastest growing economies in the world are in Africa. Europe has got a lot of innovation. Of course, you know, current political challenges and struggles aside, there are a lot of smart, interesting, committed people coming up with ideas. So much of the tech that we're using in automations these days is coming out of Eastern European countries. Without realizing it, you know, our favorite apps are from Romania and Czechoslovakia and things like that. So it's wonderful to be immersed in that environment. How does that inform the conversations you then have with leaders in North America when you come back? How does that perspective change your work with them?
A lot of my clients are from Europe, and those who aren't lead teams who are in Europe. So I bring back a lot of information, insights, knowledge that I can pass on to them through coaching about how other leaders are conducting business, how they are running their teams, and how they are growing and improving their skills.
Marvelous. Monique Danyaw, executive coach, founder of MD Consulting, thank you so much for the work you're doing. Thank you for joining us here in the studio today.
Thanks, Adrian.
For all of us here at Business Radio X, this is Dr. Adrian McIntyre, and we'll see you next time on Valley Business Radio.